my mind, this loneliness is really tied into some other kinds of lack that need to be on the radar. I think we're not just lonely in terms of our relationships, but we're also alienated from the places that we live. We're so fragmented, driving around everywhere. We don't have a lot of time on the ground in our own neighborhood. So I went from loneliness to belonging. What we really desire is a sense of belonging. Hey, everybody. You're listening to the Embedded Church Podcast, where we share stories about walkable churches creating new levels of belonging with their neighbors. I'm Eric Jacobson.
And I'm Sarah Joy Prope, and we'll be your hosts on today's episode of the Embedded Church Podcast. Hey, y'all. Thanks for tuning in to this last episode of season two. 2020 has been a year like no other for most of us. I hope that the stories we've highlighted on this season have provided some dynamic examples of how we can press in as the church in our neighborhoods to bring shalom and restoration for those in proximity to us. Today, I interview my co-host, Eric Jacobson, about his latest book, Three Pieces of Glass: Why We Feel Lonely in a World Mediated by Screens. In his book, Eric explores the topic of loneliness through the lens of belonging. And I think what's really unique is that Eric draws some important connections between the physical built environment and how it plays a role in our development of belonging. And he shares some helpful thoughts about ways that we can be catalysts of belonging, both as individuals and as members of the church in our communities. So thanks for tuning in today and listening in as we explore Eric's book in more depth. I hope you'll be encouraged to pick up a copy of his book and dig in deeper yourself. I'm really excited because today I get the joy of interviewing Eric and ask him some questions about his new book that just came out in May of this year. So May of 2020. Listeners, if you don't have a copy yet, I highly recommend it. It's called Three Pieces of Glass. And we will get to dive into what those three pieces of glass are in our interview today and how that actually relates to being an embedded church and the built environment and all those great things that we talk about on this podcast. And I would also say that this book feels really fitting and unfitting in some ways. And Eric, I'm sure we'll touch on that as well, but very fitting for the times that we are in terms of talking about loneliness and kind of this crisis of isolation that we've actually found ourselves in with the COVID pandemic in the recent months. But then also how that's made us use virtual technology in new ways that Eric kind of talks about how that's been detrimental to our connections in the past. And I think you would still come to that conclusion in your thesis, but we'll get to flesh that out a little bit more. So,
sounds great.
All right. So I just want to start off with asking you, why did you decide to write a book about loneliness? What brought that topic to the forefront for you?
Well, you know, loneliness is a huge topic, and huge in the sense that it's getting a lot of attention as of recently. A lot of people have become aware. I mean, loneliness is growing in our culture right now for a lot of reasons, but people are becoming more aware of it. And what's interesting now is they're studying loneliness, not just as sort of a psychological problem, but more of in terms of public health. Mm-hmm. Like when people are chronically lonely, they're more likely to die than if they're chronically obese or if they're smokers, for instance, in a lot of situations. And so a lot of folks have been writing about loneliness, and there's a lot of really good books out there, but there was something missing that I noticed, and that was a lot of the books on loneliness really key in on the relational dimension. We're lacking the friendships that we desire to have or think that we should have, and that makes us feel lonely. But in my mind, this loneliness is really tied into some other kinds of lack that need to be on the radar as well. And that's, I think we're not just lonely in terms of our relationships, but we're also alienated from the places that we live. We're so fragmented, driving around everywhere. We don't have a lot of time on the ground in our own neighborhood. So we don't feel connected to our own neighborhood in a lot of cases. And that's connected to the people who live in our neighborhood. So I wanted a little more broad understanding of the problem And so I went from loneliness to belonging. What we really desire is a sense of belonging, which belonging for me is a term that encapsulates our relationships, our connection to place, and kind of the stories that weave around the people and the places where we live. And that's what we really desire, is to belong. And oftentimes when we feel a lack of belonging, one of the ways we describe that is lonely. But I think it's a richer term than a lot of people are thinking about right now.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think that really roots us in a place. And that belonging piece is the piece that isn't talked about as much necessarily. So the loneliness gets talked about a lot, but not the flip side and the belonging. But I think that your book does a good job of really setting that up, and specifically what that looks like for the Christian community and the church to be central players in that dynamic of encouraging spaces for people to belong in very deep ways. I was going to mention that I recently listened to a podcast with Brené Brown and Vivek Murthy, who's the former Surgeon General of the United States. And they were talking a lot about loneliness. That was the whole point of the podcast. And they were talking about it. It results from the gap between the connections you need and the connections you have. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes people think, well, you know, if I'm in a great marriage, or if I have like really great roommates, or if I'm plugged in with this particular social club, then I won't be lonely. But then so often people who do have these connections still find themselves lonely. You can be in a large group and still feel lonely, or you can have a great family relationship and still feel lonely. And so there's these dimensions of loneliness that what we all struggle with. They described it in terms of intimate loneliness, which is in terms of more of a marriage or a deep relationship like that, or relational or social loneliness, which is a yearning for quality friendships, or even a collective loneliness, which is a hunger for a network or a community of people who have similar interests. And as they set it up, I thought a lot about your book. And I was like, oh, Eric sets up that same framework, except he does it from that flip side of belonging. And I really like the way that you set that up. And so I'd love for you to walk us through your different levels of belonging. And we can talk about why each one of those is so important for our well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like their conceptualization of it. I think that's a really good book. I think the book you're referring to is Together by Vivek Murthy.
And they did a podcast interview about that.
Yeah, book. So really good stuff. And I think we're working in similar terrain in some ways. Probably the way I'm breaking down loneliness into various components, I add one more level. So Where they go from intimate to social or relational, I probably take their second term and break it into half. So I want to say intimate is the relationship you would have with your spouse or really close best friend or like a soulmate or a mentor for whom you could say anything to.
Yeah.
We need connection at that level. Then there's the personal level, which is the kind of relationship we have with our own family, not just our immediate family, but our extended family, people that come into our homes, even a small group at your church would kind of fit that level. People who you feel really comfortable with, they're in your home. They can open your fridge without asking for permission, You know, the fridge friends concept. So that's,
they know where the water glasses are.
Exactly. So there's that. But then outside of your home, your neighborhood friends. I still want to consider that as a kind of social, where you might know people's names or you recognize them. You know that you share something in common in the neighborhood. That's what I call the social level. You can talk with these people a little bit. The relationship you have with the grocery store checker at your local market is one of those. So that's where I'm being maybe a little more refined in my categorization than they are, but definitely thinking about those same things.
Yeah. And then you talk about one more in terms of that public belonging.
So public is, you may not know the person at all, but you share some external characteristic. You live in the same city. You have some things in common. You might be fans of the same sports club or something like that. But you have a sense of, once you kind of connect with each other, you realize you belong to one another. One of the ways I've helped people with that is if you're on an international trip, let's say you're flying from Paris and you're coming home and you're waiting at the airport and you bump into someone and you find out that they're also from St. Paul.
Yeah.
You've never met them, but all of a sudden there's a little bit of a connection.
Right.
Like, oh,
right.
But do you know so-and-so? Or do you talk about places that you love? Or all of a sudden you feel really connected to that person, even though you've never met them. You share a public relationship with, you have a public belonging between the two of you because you share that from St. Paul-ness.
Right. For me, I live in a neighborhood that is very walkable. I live on a commercial corridor that has a lot of shops and little restaurants and hardware stores, things like that. And so one of the things that I find that is actually really helpful for me on days where I have more of a loneliness in my heart is stepping actually out onto that street and immediately being part of the rhythm of the neighborhood. And that's kind of that public belonging. Is I may not know these people, but we're all, you know, shopping on Grand Avenue and we're part of this rhythm. And there's just something really life-giving about that.
Oh, absolutely.
I think too, I was going to say, now in your book, I think you talk about it's a great space for people watching, and that's kind of a public belonging that happens. And I would say that's also very much the street that I live on is it's great people watching, and it just makes me feel part of a life of something outside of myself.
I'm sure there's, I mean, I've not been to your neighborhood, but I sense there's a culture that you're keying into, and these other people, even though you don't know them, they know that culture. They, they're following the same rhythms, the cadences. And it, I love that scene. Not that scene, but the chapter in Jane Jacobs' Death and Life of Great American City is the ballet of street life.
Right.
And she's just, because in hers is Hudson Street, and she really articulates the rhythm, and she sits out there, and she doesn't, in that chapter, mention that she knows any of these people by name, but she knows the rhythms, and that makes her feel really connected to that place.
So why is this sense of belonging so important to our well-being? I mean, you've talked about the health statistics and all of that, but is there more beyond that that you could say to this?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, this is another place where looking at this from a Christian or theological perspective can be helpful. You know, one of the things we can identify is that from Scripture, we discover we're all created to be with other people at various levels. We're also placed in a particular environment. And that's something that isn't always on the radar for Christian reflection on these things. I really do a lot of thinking about the Garden of Eden and this notion that we were not only created good, but we were placed good. Mm. And so God put us in a place, and part of our flourishing was connected to that place. And, you know, there's a whole like theology of place in the Bible that I think is really rich, where you can think about being in the place that God wants you to be is part of what it means to be blessed. And whenever there's a curse or a problem, it has to do with exile from that place.
Right.
From that place.
Displaced.
Right. And there's always kind of a calling us back. You know, Jesus says, I go to prepare a place for you.
That's beautiful. I love it. So in your book, you state that place is essential to a sense of belonging. And as we talked about earlier, some of these discussions around loneliness have seemed to have left out that element of place.
Yeah.
And so you bring that in. So can you talk a little bit more about how place is essential to belonging?
There's a couple ways that I think place is an important piece of the puzzle. One is because we're created to be in place, we're created and placed as embodied creatures. I think we do connect with the places that we live. I mean, that one of the examples I use is the phenomenon of being homesick. And my particular experience with homesickness is helpful for describing this is I travel with my family. We travel about every 3 years. We go on a long trip and we're all together and they're really bonding as a family. But inevitably on those trips, at some point throughout the trip, I'll feel a twinge of homesickness, which is an interesting phenomenon when you're with the five people that you're closest to in the world. Like relationally, I'm really happy that I'm with my family, but I'm still feeling homesick. And so I've asked myself, what am I actually homesick for?
Yeah.
But I'm really homesick for the place that we live, the smell and the sights and the way the trees blossom at this time of year. And we do have this deep connection to place that, whether we're keyed into it or not, is really a key part of our sense of belonging. But the other one that I think is important, where place plays a significant role, really has to do with the formation of friendships. So one of the problems with a lot of the solutions to the problem of loneliness is there's kind of a programmatic approach to solving loneliness. Okay, you know, Mrs. X is lonely. Let's set up an organization where she'll get a call from a friend, you know, or whatever. And it's really hard to set up a friendship. I mean, it can help a little bit alleviate the sting of someone who's really chronically alone and doesn't have any friends. But really, in most cases, our deepest friendships are formed when we are living close to one another and we're, and for whatever reason, we're spending time, a lot of time together, and we have that proximity. That's why a lot of friendships are formed in college. Mm-hmm. Because we have that experience of sharing the same place. We see each other like multiple times a day.
Yeah.
And friendships really form that way. And so really, if it, in some way, to even to solve the relational aspect of the problem of loneliness, place is an important component, because we need environments or places where friendships can form naturally. So we don't have to program friendships.
Yeah.
And so creating settings like, you know, gathering spots in your neighborhood, or creating rhythms in our life where we run into the same people on a regular basis, those kinds of settings can help us form the kinds of friendships that we most need. So,
yeah. And I think that's really important for adults.
Exactly.
Because you give the college example. And I remember that first year out of college and thinking, I have no friends. And I don't know how to make friends.
That's so true. I think that happens to everybody, unless they figure out some way to stay on a little bit longer. But there's that shock of like, adult life is, okay, now I don't have people that I see multiple times a day. And I got to figure out how to program friendships into my life. And then our lives get really busy.
Right.
I know you love the word as much as I do. You love the word proximity, but that's such a key element of, and I know this isn't possible for everybody, but wherever you find yourself in life and where you happen to be living or whatnot, but to really, I think, pay attention to the people that are proximate to you.
Yeah.
Like what kind of connections can you make with people who live close by? Because those kinds of friendships, have the potential for being the kinds of friendships that are really valuable to you. The kind of friends that you drop by because you're on your way somewhere else, you intend it to be like a 2-minute conversation, but it stretches out to be an hour and a half because you're just enjoying the moment or whatnot. Whereas if you were to call that same friend and they lived across town and said, hey, do you have an hour to get together? It'd be hard to do.
Right, right.
But I love the proximate friendships have a really special potential for
definitely
for great friends.
For me in St. Paul, that's one of the things that I've loved the most is having a few of those friends be here in my neighborhood so that on snow days when roads are pretty much undrivable, I can just put on my snow boots and trudge a few blocks and enjoy a hot dinner with some friends.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I really valued having that friendship nearby.
Yeah. I bet that those also were became more important during the COVID crisis, I'm guessing.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, some of my closest friends who live 3 blocks away also housed me for 5 days during the protests and riots.
Yes, absolutely.
Because my apartment being on a main commercial corridor was all boarded up and they said, come on over and sleep on the couch. So I was thankful for that.
Absolutely. That's great.
So as your title suggests, you assert that there are 3 pieces of glass, or I would say maybe modern devices that have effectively hindered a healthy development of this sense of belonging in our culture. Can you walk us through what those 3 pieces of glass are and give us maybe that 10,000 foot view of how they've disintegrated our belonging?
Yeah, absolutely. And so a lot of people are concerned about how the smartphone has changed a lot of our behaviors and our patterns in life, that, you know, you see people walking around staring at screens and ignoring the people that are right next to them. But the contention that I'm making in this book is that that particular problem didn't start with the smartphone. It actually goes back further to some earlier sort of society-wide developments in which we chose away from direct face-to-face contact and a more mediated way of interacting with one another. It's walking backwards from the smartphone. Okay. So the first piece of glass is the automobile windshield. And I'm not talking about the invention of the automobile as a way of getting from point A to point B. I'm talking about what happened sort of post-World War II, where we decided to set up a society where driving would be the expected means of transport. But we treat each other differently when we meet each other driver to driver, be mediated by that piece of glass. Where really nice people do really rude things while driving their cars, right?
I'm not going to lie. That's me sometimes.
Yeah, I know. I wasn't going to name names, but now that you mentioned it, I've heard stories. No, anyway, all of us do that, right?
Yeah.
And it's we behave in ways that we would never do just encountering someone on the sidewalk, right? And the reason is something about seeing each other, behind the wheel of our automobile with that mediated piece of glass. We see each other not as human beings, not as fellow image bearers. We see each other as competitors for lane space and parking space and threats. Because a person driving a car, if they're drunk or if they're sleepy while driving, they can actually kill you or your children. So that's the first piece of glass. And in that sort of society reorganization around the automobile, we changed our housing patterns. So prior to World War II, houses faced forward towards the street with a front porch, big picture window, front door, the whole shebang. And then what happened was we turned our houses around so they faced the backyard and put a big garage door in the front of our house. That became the prominent feature. Because we're driving to and fro, no longer did we go out on an evening stroll and walk in the neighborhood and talk to our neighbors while they're sitting on their front porch. That practice kind of deteriorated. And so we moved indoors into our air-conditioned homes. And I think we got kind of bored. We weren't seeing our neighbors on a regular basis walking in front of our houses. And so we replaced our neighbor interaction with a second piece of glass, and that's the television screen. We watch these dramas that present us with sort of quasi-social friendships with people that we don't really know. We get really drawn into the drama of a TV show and feel like relationships because our emotions are getting all kind of stirred up, but we have no actual relationship. They don't demand anything of us. I call those kind of voyeuristic relationships. We kind of consume relationships.
Yeah, it makes me think just how we can kind of watch all the drama, but avoid the actual messiness of the drama in our own personal lives. And I think there's such a push to avoid anything that is painful or dramatic. And what's interesting to me when I think about that is like, it's actually those feelings of pain
and
joy that help us belong, right? So we're effectively cutting ourselves off from belonging when we try to remove ourselves from the pain and just voyeuristically enjoy the drama, right?
Yeah, it's a safer way to encounter people. We can encounter crazy people on TV shows and it has nothing to do with us. They make no demands on us. And so I think we kind of, I use the language of atrophy. Some of our relational instincts are atrophying. Some of our, with the automobile, some of our civic politeness has atrophied. And with our TV addiction, some of our relational instincts have atrophied. We've created a society where you can wake up in the morning and drink your cup of coffee and have your breakfast in front of a morning TV show. And then you can get in your car directly from your garage and go to your office, park in the basement, go up the elevator, go to your cubicle, spend all day in the office and return the next day. And you don't run into anyone in the public sphere face to face. Everything's been mediated by a screen. With a couple of exceptions, you might have to go to the grocery store and get groceries, or you might have to pick up your kids from school. But then, you know, the smartphone is this stopgap measure that's been invented. So now you can bring a screen with you in those settings. Now you go to the grocery store and you're standing in line with some other strangers with whom you might interact, but everyone's staring at their screen. And the weird thing about the smartphone is it kind of picks up both the incivility of the car. You know, we're really rude to each other on social media. And the kind of voyeuristic stuff of the TV, we can get really drawn into a human interest story across the world on our phones and ignore the actual person who's right next to us at the pickup line at school. And I think all these things have really pulled us away from that face-to-face human connection, which is such a key part of belonging.
Let's take this a little bit deeper into the built environment component, because on this podcast, we believe that the built environment is deeply integral to carrying out the mission of the church and to seeking the good of our neighbors. Can you give some examples of how the built environment impacts our sense of belonging in a particular place? You've touched on it a little bit through driving, but are there other examples that you can talk about?
Absolutely, the driving component, but the driving is really driven by, pardon the pun, driven by the biggest shaper of the built environment, the most influential has been this practice of zoning, which was a key planning tool in the post-World War II era, where we really divided up our cities into areas for residences and areas for commercial shopping and areas for offices and areas for kids to play sports. And we created this really fragmented environment, which was somewhat convenient for the car, but it caused us to spend a lot more time driving cars. And it was much, much, much less walkable. And so one of the contentions that I make is that walking from place to place really is a better way to experience belonging or to cultivate a sense of belonging. The car is not very good for experiencing a sense of belonging. It tends to fragment your life. You know, if your church is 20 miles away from your house and your workplace is 30 miles in another direction and then your kids play sports, you know, 15 miles in a different direction, there's not going to be a lot of overlap there.
Right.
And so it's going to be really hard to form the kind of comprehensive friendships that would happen more in a walkable environment. So the built environment, you know, kind of, I kind of divvy up life as the pre-World War II era, where we had walkable neighborhoods where kids could walk to the sports field to play sports. You could walk to a coffee shop to have coffee. You would get your groceries, you know, maybe you'd drive, but it wouldn't be very far. And in any one of those settings, you would run into people who were not only part of your kid's sports team, but they were also neighbors. So with each outing, you had an opportunity to form relationships and build on relationships with people who lived in proximity to your life. And so this whole idea of zoning and fragmenting our lives into different zones, I think has really been hurtful for belonging. And car also takes a lot of space. With zoning comes parking requirements. And so because everyone's driving everywhere, every grocery store needs to have so many parking spaces. Every church needs to have so many parking spaces. And we invested a lot less in things like public plazas and gathering right. spots where a lot of those things were converted into parking lots. Older cities had these gracious places to gather and whatnot. And a lot of now, a lot of cities just have a lot of parking lots, which don't gather people. And the cities don't invite us to walk and to stop with a beautiful fountain and a plaza, those kinds of things. And right. so it's hard to form connections with these places.
Donald Shoup, the parking guru,
yes.
notes that there's about 8 parking stalls per car in the United States.
That's crazy.
So we have far dedicated more land to parking in our cars than even us as human beings, I think.
It might feel abstract when we're just talking about it, but when you're walking around, you know, one way to maybe think about it is if you're in a pleasant sort of either small town main street, or if you're in a downtown of a nice city and you have to walk like 9 blocks to get from one shop to another destination, that can be a pleasant experience in a lot of cases because it's a lot to see. Mm-hmm. And you might pass by an interesting plaza and some cool buildings and whatnot. But if you got to get to like from Petco to Target, and you got to get across like one of those suburban kind of office park kind of parking lots, it's just exhausting to get from one to the other. You kind of feel like I just should get in my car.
So what do we do about this? How can the church serve as an agent of reconciliation in this crisis of belonging we're seeing? Can the church play a role?
So yeah, what's kind of interesting about my take on this is I think the church does play a critical role, but the church can't do it by itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, so far as these problems have to do with some policy issues where we might need to change zoning laws and build places that are more walkable and build more gathering spots in the civic realm, the church can't do that. The city and the community can do that, but the church can have that on its radar. And the church can get involved in those conversations. In some cases, the church can host those conversations because
right.
churches often have these nice sanctuaries and large buildings and gathering spaces to have the kind of conversations that are needed to make those kind of changes. But the church can't initiate a lot of change in the built environment outside of its own property. So that's one thing. But what I think the church can do is can help be a catalyst of belonging. You know, church is one of the institutions that you can formally belong to usually by some kind of membership class. But the church can kind of model for the culture what belonging is supposed to look like. Leslie Newbegin, who's a missiologist, talks about the church being a sign, an instrument, and a foretaste of the gospel. In my work, I take Newbegin's formula and put belonging instead of the gospel. Belonging is not the gospel, but it's related to the gospel in some helpful ways. So the church can be a sign of belonging by being the kind of place where anyone can belong regardless of race or socioeconomic status or coolness or whatnot, that we have an inclusive kind of feel.
Right.
So you don't have to, because this has got a little bit of a tangent, but I'll say it. One of the things that kind of the aha moments in writing the book is I was talking about belonging and I'm really pro belonging, but I realized halfway into my book that not every form of belonging is good and edifying for us, right?
So yeah.
The kind of belonging that's required to be part of a clique in high school, for instance, is not necessarily good for you, right? You have to conform in a certain way. You have to be mean to all the people that don't belong to that clique. And then you're constantly terrified that you're going to get kicked out of your clique if you gain weight or start not, you know, dressing less cool than everyone else. And it's a very insecure kind of belonging. And so I talk about there's good belonging, kingdom belonging, and there's bad belonging, worldly belonging, that, you know, and good belonging, the kingdom belonging is more inclusive and it's welcoming. So the church can model that kind of kingdom belonging, hopefully,
yeah,
within its own membership. The church can be an instrument of belonging by continually opening its doors and opening its heart to people on the outside. So people feel like there's a way in. As we grow in intimacy within the church, it's not an insular kind of intimacy, but it's an open, porous intimacy that other people can join into. So we can be an instrument of belonging. And then the third thing is kind of a foretaste of belonging, and that is the church can be a place where someone can experience belonging even before they believe. You know, our church has a really great youth group, and the youth group has a really great mission trip where they go to California and they process peaches for the hungry all around the world. One of the things I really like about it is a lot of kids will go to that who haven't yet decided to become a Christian or join the youth group in that formal sense of the word. But on that trip, they feel like they belong, and they do
belong. Yeah.
You know, they're part of this mission, and they really buy into the mission. And I think a lot of churches have discovered that a lot of people in our culture want to experience belonging before they're ready to really consider the beliefs that mm-hmm. are foundational to who we are. So that's kind of how I'm using the word foretaste. In a similar vein, we can throw a party for our block, or we can do some kind of activity at the church, and we can welcome our neighbors to experience that kind of intergenerational belonging that we have at our church without having to go through a membership class and believe the things we
right.
do. They get a taste of belonging that right. we think is helpful to them.
And I think that is so intriguing for people who don't have easy access to that sense of belonging that you describe, because I think about me in my own life with being part of a church small group and having that intergenerational companionship kind of through that weekly meeting. And I've just, you know, talked to coworkers and different people about my small group from time to time. And in some ways they're like, that's kind of weird. Like,
right.
you just have this group of like people that like, some people are 20, some people are 60, you know,
right.
that you can call on them for things. And I'm like, yeah.
One of the challenges for the church, I think, in terms of connecting with our neighbors, is to allow our neighbors to see us in community outside of our walls. You know, so like what you're describing is really typical, and it's good. You as an individual might run into coworkers and you can describe for them what it's like to be in small groups. But I think one of the really intriguing challenges is, how do you do community outside of the walls of the church, or outside of even the walls of our homes,
right.
in a way that's visible to the public? So one way we've done that, just a small example, but I've got a group, kind of a small group that meets at my house once a week for dinner. And we decided to do something for the neighborhood. We wanted to help plant flowers in our neighborhood district. That was a project that had been done for the most part by the local business district association, but they were kind of shorthanded. And so we decided to kind of lend a hand as a small group, but we couldn't do it all by ourselves as well. So it was kind of a combined partnership between the business yeah. district and our small group. And what I thought was interesting about that was our business district leaders, who I know from a kind of different context, got to see my small group, but mm-hmm. you know, experience it, not just have me tell them about
right.
it. They're like, oh,
right.
these people, boy, they don't look the same. They look different, you know, they're different, but they're all connected somehow and they're helping out. And
yeah. I think that's such a key point of making sure, reminding people of like, go outside with these ideas. That's one of the things I always encourage churches is, take what you're doing inside and take it outside. Let the neighborhood see, let the community be a part of it.
I kind of want to clarify something. When I said earlier that there's kingdom belonging, which is good, and there's worldly belonging, which is bad, I absolutely believe there's a good kind of belonging and a bad kind of belonging. But what I think, I hope our listeners, I want to make sure they understand, is that I don't by that mean that Christians have an exclusive domain of the good kind of belonging and secular people have the bad. Sometimes churches can be really guilty of the bad kind of belonging when they become really insular and hating of the outsider and that kind of stuff. On the other hand, I have to acknowledge there's some secular organizations that represent a kind of belonging that I can't help but say it's good. It's really right. good. And the church should do more like that. That in the book, I talk about an organization in our town called the Hilltop Artists in Residence, which is a glassblowing thing for young people to learn glassblowing skills. And a lot of the people they work with come from broken homes and socioeconomic disadvantage, but they learn these great skills. And whenever I go to the Hilltop Artists to their hot shop and see them in action, it's just this beautiful picture of belonging, and it's completely secular. I mean, so I know some of the staff are Christians, but it's not a Christian organization.
Right.
And I often think to myself, this is what the church should be like. You know, that they're actually doing what we are called to do better than we're doing in this instance.
Right.
Yeah, I use the phrase common grace belonging. It's kind of a Dutch Reformed idea that sometimes people outside of the formal Christian community can be doing things that are God-honoring without using all the lingo that we use.
So we've talked about how the church can play a role. And this podcast is called the Embedded Church Podcast. And so there's a distinction we make in terms of what embedded churches are. So can you share for our listeners again, just a quick explanation of what we mean by this term embedded? And then do you think that the embedded church in particular has unique opportunities to serve in this arena of belonging?
Certainly. And as we always do, whenever we use the term embedded, I find that a helpful clarifying term, but I want to make it really clear that not every church needs to fit into this framework. There's a lot of non-embedded churches that are doing amazing work and I think can benefit from the kind of stuff we're talking about in this podcast. So I don't want to leave anyone out with this term, but I do think it's a kind of church that I think has an interesting and unique role to play in some of the cultural and societal work that needs to happen in the next decade or so. So an embedded church is one that meets the public right of way, like a church that comes right up to the sidewalk, as opposed to being fronted by a large parking lot. That could be a storefront church, or it could be a classic church on the corner with a grand staircase. Another feature would be a church that de-emphasizes parking. And by that, I mean, some of the embedded churches don't have a parking lot at all. There's just street parking. That's kind of typical in an urban setting. But they might have a parking lot, but the parking lot maybe isn't large enough to meet all of the needs of people. The expectation is some people are going to walk and some people are going to drive and some people are going to show up on bike. A third feature would be being in a mixed use neighborhood. So there's not just houses surrounding the church, but there's also businesses and nonprofits and government institutions and whatnot. And why that's important is you tend to have more natural walking in those kinds of settings. In a residential neighborhood, people will walk for exercise, but they're not walking to get groceries or they're not walking to get their hair cut. But when you have a mixed-use neighborhood, people are out walking as just a normal form of transportation, and that provides a lot of opportunities for interacting with them. And the fourth characteristic is a sense of mission to the neighborhood. So the church really is desiring to form connections and engage its neighbors on their turf rather than expecting everyone to come in. The reason I say that fourth one is there's a lot of churches that physically meet all the characteristics of an embedded church, but they've developed, for whatever reason, more of a fortress mentality. Mm-hmm. But the neighborhood is a danger to us and we got to just protect our turf. And that kind of church, I think, is not embedded in the full sense because they're not taking advantage of their location to connect with their neighbors. I think there's a kind of unique role that embedded churches can play because they can be catalysts of belonging. They don't have to engage with their neighbors by setting up all these programs. I mean, they might set up programs, but they can be organically connected with their neighbors. As people walk to church or the staff walks around the neighborhood or uses the neighborhood facilities like coffee shops for meetings and whatnot, they have a lot of organic ways they can connect with their neighbors, but they can be part of the conversations that are happening around belonging. I know in my church, we've just adopted this 10-year vision of ending loneliness in our neighborhood, which is a really ambitious goal, but we want to do it. And, you know, I was talking to the manager of our local bank and she asked me how the church was going. And I said, oh, we just did this 10-year vision. And she said, what's the 10-year vision? So to end loneliness. And she got so excited. And all of a sudden she was like, oh yeah, you know, half our customers are elderly folks that come in here like on a fairly regular basis. And I'm convinced they don't actually need to do all these transactions. They're coming in because it's a social connection. And all of a sudden she was like wanting to help me solve the problem of loneliness in the neighborhood. She saw that as a problem. She understood her role as helping with that a little bit. So all of a sudden we're working on the same team. And I think the fact that we share that, you know, we're just in the same neighborhood and we have an organic connection. Instead of me having this big campaign where I invite all the neighbors into our church to do something.
Right, right. It makes me think about the churches that aren't necessarily in embedded neighborhoods, but they do have that fourth mindset that you talk about in terms of the mission to the neighborhood. They do care about that, but maybe they're not, their physical features don't really align with kind of those other distinctions that you set up. But I think one of the ways that those types of churches can still be in those conversations with the neighborhood is doing things like attending neighborhood association meetings. Here, I've had a church that I've worked with that's in a suburban area, you know, where their property is pretty effectively isolated in many ways from a lot of walkable things. But they've been at the neighborhood association meetings and have really taken a step in trying to get plugged in that way and understand kind of what does the neighborhood need? How can we be at that mission table with them? Even if it's not embedded in the sense that we talk about.
No, so. I think that's absolutely true. And what, I can't remember which of our guests said this, but this idea of like every, when a church has that mentality, they might be in a more isolated environment. They might have a large parking lot, which is, you know, not normally part of an embedded church. But if they have that mind frame of like, okay, how do we support this neighborhood? How do we get involved with these things? Then everything about their church could be a potential asset for the neighborhood.
You know, right.
They could offer up the parking lot for an event that needs that kind of space. So they could offer up their sanctuary for a community conversation that needs to happen. They just have to work at it differently. They have to.
Right. It has to be more intentional. It's not as organic, like you said earlier, that the organicness of the local is what enables that to happen maybe more easily. Right.
Right. Absolutely. So.
You talk about too these policy shaped choices and liturgically shaped choices that people or churches as institutions, I think, can make. So can you maybe talk a little bit about those terms, and can you provide an example for the type of choice you mean when you talk about policy shaped versus liturgically shaped?
Yeah. So policy shaped, that's kind of getting back to what I've been talking about with zoning and whatnot. Zoning is a policy. And parking minimums are policies that I think can drive us into environments that are hard to form belonging type associations. And so that's where I think we want to be cognizant of those conversations as those policy questions come up in the public realm. Because even in very suburban environments, I think people are talking about walkability. They're wanting to create, you know, more of a town center feel. A lot of them are thinking about either eliminating parking minimums or adopting things like district parking requirements. I think getting involved in those conversations to help encourage policies that encourage walking and don't make every concession for driving. Right. Those are happening even in suburban environments. And I think Christians who are keyed into that can be part of those conversations. And liturgically shaped choices, I'm sort of building on James K. A. Smith's idea. His claim is that a lot of the choices that we make in life aren't discrete choices where we just decide to do this as opposed to that. A lot of the choices that we make are really embedded in patterns and rhythms that we do. Mm-hmm. And so one of the areas that I key in on is transportation. So how we get from point A to point B can have a real impact on how we experience belonging. I think getting into a car is one of the worst ways to foster a sense of belonging. And so what I would say is a liturgically shaped choice is choosing another means of transportation when you can. So mm-hmm. if you can take your bike, if you can walk, if you can take public transit, all those things are going to have a lot of advantages towards connecting you to your neighborhood and to the people in your neighborhood. For some people, they literally can't make those choices because their environment is so set up, you know, only to drive. But in a lot of cases, we can choose to get from point A to point B walking or driving. I would even say, just as a concession for folks who are in more of a suburban environment, even if you live like 20 miles from your church and there's no way you're going to walk or bike to church on a Sunday morning, you can drive your car and park, you know, half a mile away and walk the remaining half a mile.
Yeah. And that's, I encourage churches to do that.
Yeah. I love that idea. And I think that's just because I really do think that a little bit of time on the ground in the neighborhood around your church is going to give you a little bit more insight into the neighborhood, what's going on, and right. a little more sensitivity to the kinds of things that, you know, the church should be caring about and praying about when they gather.
Definitely. And I think too, you can frame it in terms of start small if you have to, but maybe it's you take the bus once to church, once a month or something. But again, that just that exposure to this is public transit in my city. And I think it creates a sense of empathy for those who that really is their only means, right? So suddenly riding the bus and you recognize, oh man, this trip that was like 5 miles took me an hour.
You right. know? Absolutely.
And it's painful. And it's like, well, yeah, but there is a large sect of the population where that's every day for them, right?
Absolutely.
And so being able to understand that and start to see that, it makes you a better advocate for a system that would work better for everyone.
Right.
So
I would also say that, you know, some of our sense of what's feasible or what's reasonable is culturally shaped as much as physically real. So what I mean by that is we lived for 3 years in Pasadena, which is in Southern California. And before we moved there, our expectation was Southern California is like freeway driving mecca. Everything, that's the epicenter of driving culture. Well, what we didn't realize was Pasadena was actually built before Los Angeles, and it was built as a very walkable community. And so still has the infrastructure of a walkable community. But being in Southern California, the culture was you just drive everywhere. So what we did is we got there and we weren't part of that culture. So we walked. We walked our kids to school. We walked to the dentist. We walked. And people were startled when we showed up to the dentist office and we didn't need the parking pass.
Yeah. Because
we walked there and it was only like less than half a mile. And it was a very pleasant walk. One of the things that we did in 3 years was we helped our neighbors figure out that you actually can walk where they didn't think that you could, or you could ride your bike. And it was just a cultural shift.
I'm curious to find out from you if the COVID pandemic has impacted your thesis. I alluded to it at the beginning, but would love to hear from you. Are you standing strong that three pieces of glass kind of detrimental? And even though the Zoom culture has been great for a time, it's not where we're meant to be long term. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I actually recant everything I said in the book. It's all wrong.
I think we have to erase this whole episode.
No, COVID was an interesting development for this book to come out during this time, because obviously, as I'm talking about the problems with screen-mediated communication, we're almost overnight doing everything on screens. And I couldn't have imagined, you know, even 4 months prior, the idea that I would be preaching to a camera on Sunday morning and during the passing of the peace, telling my parishioners to get out their phones and text somebody and say, "Peace of the Lord be with you." But all those things happened and they're still happening. So I guess upon reflection, I would say COVID, I think, helped us see that we can use screens for a lot of things. I have to concede that screens are useful. And I've never really been against technology, and I'm not really against screens. Obviously, I have a car and I have a smartphone and I have a TV, actually a couple of TVs and a couple of cars. But what I think is those screen-mediated connections that we have with people aren't ultimately satisfying. They aren't ultimately what we need. They can be useful as stand-ins or stopgaps, or can facilitate face-to-face contact, but they don't replace face-to-face contact. I think in a lot of ways, this COVID pandemic and all the lockdown stuff has really sharpened our hunger for face-to-face communication. I know folks in my church are really missing being together bodily. And when you kind of press that question, what are you missing? Are you missing the singing? Are you missing the preaching? Really, I think most of them would say, we just miss being together. We miss being in the same room and whatnot, and being bodily present to one another. But I think we're becoming more aware of how much we need simply to be bodily present with one another, even if we're not accomplishing things.
Yeah, I think that's true. Tish Harrison Warren wrote a New York Times piece where she talked about missing that bodily engagement as a church. And she even talked about, I just miss the way people smell. But it's so true, you know, and that's almost that sense of belonging, right? When you can hug somebody and you know what the smell is that's associated with them. And there's just something that brings to it.
Yeah. So the other thing that I think COVID is, and I alluded to this earlier, but I think it's kind of helped underscore your term of proximity, because not only are we shut in, but we're not, at least in the early stages, we weren't supposed to drive anywhere. And so, you know, we were able to get out and walk in our neighborhoods, and the people you run into walking your neighborhood are your neighbors. And I know that it made us much, much more aware of the people who live within a mile of our house, because we were walking at least once a day and they were walking at least once a day. And we weren't in a particular rush because everything had been canceled.
Yeah.
So we had these long, you know, socially distant conversations with people that we just kind of barely knew.
All right. Well, signing off, what impact do you hope that your book will have on your readers?
Yeah. Well, I hope ultimately it's going to help alleviate some loneliness in my readers, that they would recognize that that need for loneliness, that need for connection and belonging is real and it needs to be addressed. I think one of the problems is a lot of the screens that I've been talking about can give a false sense of belonging connection. I liken it to like junk food or empty calories. You know, if you're really craving human relationship, you know, binging on a Netflix show and really connecting with some of those intriguing characters can feel kind of good, but it's not what you ultimately need. You ultimately need real human connection. And I hope some of what I've written in this book will help us recognize that that's what we really need and to make sure that we invest in that. It's really tempting, especially because life is pretty exhausting in a lot of ways. It's really tempting to just escape to the kind of connection that we can make over screens that demand less of us and are more on our own terms, but to recognize that that's ultimately not going to meet our deepest needs is one thing. I think hopefully people will become a little more skeptical of their screen devices in terms of what they can offer and maybe decide to put them down in various settings. One of the things I hope is that people will reduce their instinct to pull the phone out simply to make them feel less awkward and live into that awkwardness enough to be open to the possibility of connecting with another person. I hope people will not throw their phones away or sell their cars or, you know, get rid of their TVs, but use those things a little more sparingly. And then thirdly, I would say for our Christian audience and the people who are involved in churches, to really look for opportunities to partner with our secular neighbors to deal with this problem of belonging. Because I don't think it's something we can accomplish on our own as a church. We really need to get involved with public policy discussions. We really need to partner with, or at least figure out where belonging is happening outside of our doors and meet people on their turf rather than our own turf. And just open our imagination to where God is at work in our communities. And it's not always within the four walls of our church.
Well, great. Thank you so much for sharing more with us about your book. I hope that everybody goes out and picks up a copy. Three Pieces of Glass: Why We Feel Lonely in a World Mediated by Screens by Eric Jacobson. Thanks for joining us on another episode of the Embedded Church podcast. We hope that you find the stories both inspiring and insightful. Be sure to check out our website, embeddedchurch.com, to find more info about today's episode, learn more about this podcast, and access helpful urbanism resources. And a good review goes a long way, so please take a moment to rate this podcast so we can successfully share more of the stories that shape the Embedded Church.